we're in.
Hi there.
Hi.
Hey.
Good evening.
What's up?
Good morning.
Good early morning. Happy early Thursday morning to you and you and you.
Thanks to True True for closing up Wednesday night. And here we are, The Talking Show, starting out Thursday morning.
Top of the morning to you, Nicholas Miller.
Stephen Cato.
That's me. I'm Stephen Cato.
How are your sinuses doing, Steve?
You know, unusually, my sinuses are fine.
Mine are terrible.
Is it because it is allergy season now?
You know, it's just a perpetual pain for me. I have no idea. I can't differentiate between seasons. It's just like a,
So you have become a Los Angelino.
Yeah. I recently...
What are these seasons?
I don't know.
What are called seasons? These... What?
They're just fluctuations of sinus pain. I was recently trying to teach myself how to become a watercolor painter via YouTube.
Oh, cool.
And there's a channel that I follow.
I hear painting is lucrative.
Yeah, very lucrative. Although, I don't think watercolor is much. But anyhow, there was a guy who I guess had received a lot of requests to...
Silke Autoknapp does great on watercolors.
Sure.
FYI.
Okay, great. I'm still waiting for that Laura Owens watercolor series.
They exist.
I'm sure they do. Probably in a book. Very expensive book.
Check it out sometime when you are next at Ooga Booga.
I will. I think I'll be there on Friday. Will you be there on Friday?
For the Carrie Tribe.
Exactly.
Exhibit.
Yeah.
I might actually be too zonked. But finish your story.
Anyhow, there's one watercolor painter, another self-taught painter who teaches via YouTube. And he makes this amazing foggy painting of a ship out at sea in fog. And so he paints the little ship, and then he shows how to do a wash of the fog. And that's kind of how my whole nasal cavity feels. It's like that ship in the fog.
Well, Nicholas, you know, one of the areas where you and I definitely have bonded in the past, and I think it's maybe the time to share this with our radio audience, is...
Oh, dear.
Is in terms of discussing our sinuses, because although it didn't happen in the lifetime of this radio station, in between 2005 and 2007, I enjoyed a 2-year-long sinus infection.
Excellent.
And
did that affect your talking? I can't imagine.
It affected my talking.
Really?
All those passages are linked. My voice changed. It changed the timbre and nature of my voice.
So were you making prints or sculptures during those 2 years, or what happened?
I was entirely involved in music at the time.
Okay, fair enough.
So not entirely, actually, to be fair, but I was primarily involved in music. So I was either yelling, screaming, or playing drums.
I bet the yelling and screaming helped the sinuses, probably.
I doubt it. It, in fact, decreased the range and depth of my yelling. It sort of made everything more on a flat plane in the front of my face, as opposed to extending into the, using the resonant cavities of the whole head. Which, if you are stoked on real screaming, like, you know, Blixer Bargeld from Einstürzende Neubauten, for example, he uses his whole head.
Yeah, but I've never heard him achieve two-dimensional screaming, which it sounds like what you were able to do.
I mean, two-dimensional screaming is bad screaming. It's maybe my argument. A finer scream would be a three-dimensional scream.
Right.
But a professional cyclist, a sort of touring cyclist, gave me this advice. She had gone to a naturopath who had advised her how to deal with her sinus infection.
Oh, yeah.
And this is actually kind of interesting, too, because it's like also female touring cyclists in general has less cycling, has less doping than male cycling. So it's like maybe, like, the doping situation in, just as a side note, the doping situation in professional cycling has rendered the entire sport almost useless. Like they are now actually looking for cyclists who have never touched a bicycle, but who have the physical attributes of a powerful cyclist,
right,
to become new cyclists because the actual existing infrastructure of professional cycling has been so manifestly corrupt.
Right. And I remember when I was...
But women's cycling was untouched.
Yeah.
Which is wild. Sorry.
No, I was just going to say, my only experience with that was when I was taking my frequent trips to Marfa, you know, we were living in LA doing the show here, but I was...
You would go to Marfa most of the week and you would come back on Wednesdays to do the show.
Exactly.
You
know? Which the funding just dried up. But after the whole Lance Armstrong explosion, he moved out to Marfa to dry out.
That's right. That's right. You told me that.
I had many brunches with Mr. Armstrong and his lovely wife. He was sad. He was selling off the art collection. Nike wanted all their money back. This kind of stuff.
They wanted all the money back?
Yeah, which was preposterous to me.
Oh, like, my God. They must have given him so much money.
Yeah. And what you know, the all the sneakers we sold when you were doing that campaign, we now no longer have the profits from, you know?
Yeah, they still have all the money from all the sneakers and all those rubber bands. Mm-hmm.
So your touring, non-doping touring cyclist friend said what?
Well, her naturopath recommended use a microplaner, a kitchen tool I'm sure you have.
Yep. I don't have one, but I know what it is.
Go to a Sila tablet and pick one up.
Ooh, the one with the rubber handle.
Really also, good. If you want to get deluxe, there's a chainmail glove you can buy with it that keeps you from shredding your fingers.
You have to. Wow. A chainmail glove? Is it microplane branded?
It's microplane branded. And they have done an actual interesting thing where they have, like, I assume through a laser, etched the microplane logo onto the chainmail, even though the chainmail does not have, it does not have the physical body. You know, it's like, it's not the kind of thing that you could... But anyway, there is like a beautiful, beautifully clear, crisp microplane logo on the back of the chainmail glove. Yeah. So you will... buy the microplane, possibly buy the chainmail glove at Sur L'Etoile in Pasadena, maybe on your way to the Patagonia store.
I don't know how, if I buy the glove, I'm not sure how it's going to affect my compost pile every week. I mean, if the little nub of garlic is actually getting planed, it might throw the whole gentle balance off for me.
Check with your vermiculture specialist, your Silver Lake vermiculturist, and then
mine's in Brentwood, actually.
But. Oh, your Brentwood vermiculture, pardon me. And then we'll see about the chainmail glove or not. So you want to microplane the garlic into a tablespoon of honey.
Okay.
Then you stir them together, and then you let it sit for 2 minutes so it oxidizes. And this was apparently very important. Mm-hmm. Then you sort of down the hatch with that.
Ooh, that sounds painful.
You do it 3 times a week. And it got rid of my 2-year-long sinus infection, as opposed to all the antibiotics,
etc.
All the various inhalers, all the bullshit. And so, like, this is, to my mind, this is the only thing that actually has worked.
Just microplane garlic in
honey, wait.
Oxidized, okay.
And the other thing to mention about it is that the garlic, as like an antiviral agent, also clears up your skin.
Oh, cool.
Poisons your breath, clears up your skin. So you are unmakeout withable, but are good to look radiant
at. Yeah.
To behold. Yeah.
Sounds great.
It's that's my advice to you suffering from some sort of perpetual sinus unease. Because this is an allergies at the moment, right? That's not what you're thinking.
I don't think so. I mean, nothing seems to be in bloom, but...
The jacaranda is our guest tonight. So to divert the topic from the fascinating world inside Nicholas and my own face.
Mm-hmm. Our shared sinus.
Sinai. to divagate from the conflicted Sinai region... of the talking show. People are being abducted in the Sinai Peninsula. Like, do you know about this? Like, crazy shit's going on over there right now.
I haven't seen that.
We'll talk about it next week. Our current guest tonight is notionally connected to the Holy Land, but only maybe very distantly. And to be fair, the thing Nicholas and I just did actually is a in a way, a fine representation of sort of like a word vomit if it were to be said, because there was no control. It just sort of just came out.
Glossolalia or whatever the...
Well, glossolalia feels a little more more ululating and a little more phonic. Purely phonic and less semic.
Hmm.
If I was going to put those things on a continuum.
Right.
So getting semic again.
Sure.
Our guests tonight are Karen Edelman and Quixote. Quixote will be a more subtle presence.
Mm-hmm.
We'll see. We'll see how subtle Quixote is. And maybe let's just have Karen take us, put us out of our misery.
Excellent.
Yeah, we're done.
Way to go. Let's hear it. Karen Edelman and Quixote.
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 You can use that chair again. However you would prefer.
Okay. Whoa, down here. Doop-a-doop-doop. I am going to need to direct the flow since I need to see my thing. Okay. How's this sound-wise?
Let's get you a little more in.
I need to see my thing. Yeah, stand it up. Whoa, all right.
That's a complicated.
I know. Okay. All right, Quixote, be a good boy. Come on, sit here. Okay, hi, everybody. This is Karen, and it's past my bedtime. And I'm holding a squirming dog, so... This is a recording for the radio that flows from my logophilia, a word meaning the love of words and their meanings, from the Greek origins logos, the word, and philia, love. Much of this text actually first began as an essay entitled Logorrhea, Word Vomit, or Throw It Out If It Doesn't Work / and See What Sticks, which was then worked into the so-called slash mark section of my written MFA thesis, Conduit/Container. Tracking a kind of babbling speech that might serve as a link between performer and performance, audio and audience, resonance and resonance, and meaning. I'm also going to read a bit from the final section, Container, and expound on the etymological derivations of as many of the relevant words as possible, several of which were originally footnoted throughout the piece, and several dozens of which comprise the glossary. Why speak? Why write? Why make objects? Why even attempt to make sense of anything? Descartes was close when he was writing that his humanity could be reduced in essence to its thinkingness, but I would argue that in his Meditations, he instead demonstrates the real essence of being human. Demonstrate from de entirely and monstrare to point out, show from monstrum, divine omen, wonder, see monster. He tried to think through his thinking to translate a thought or feeling into an expression through words. The oscillation between an interior and an exterior thought, idea, or expression is extremely difficult to arrest in order to annotate, to expound on its structure, but is exactly this slippage that draws so many into the process of refining crafts for the purposes of communicating ideas. In this post-post-structuralist landscape, neither ideas nor their expressions could be said to derive exclusively from either internal or external conditions, but are produced between the two, always in concert. But what is the purpose of producing these relational instances, these events, these manifestations of a consciousness? Why bring any one subjectivity, that is, one's own, into such explicit contact with the public discourse within which it is constructed, against which it is understood? Of course, the public discourse does not exist without the many instances of interaction provided by private subjectivities that operate within it. So is it even possible to distinguish between these private acts and the public space within which they occur as expressions? In ancient Greece, a rhetorical concept entitled parhesia encompassed not just the freedom to speak as one wishes, but in fact the moral obligation to do so on behalf of the public good. Socrates, the prime example, was so steadfast in his desire to provoke other Athenians to care for themselves that he compared himself to a horsefly, ceaselessly pricking the attention of those around him. He thought himself necessary for preventing them from slipping into a sluggish slumber. The parhesiast must reveal the full truth. Socrates willingly continued his interminable quest to convince Athenians to care for themselves, even as it hindered his own ability to do so. Ultimately, he accedes to a death sentence, so deep was his commitment. Foucault points out in Discourse and Truth that such risks are inherent to the notion of parhesia. One speaks one's beliefs, all of them, to one's own detriment, even if, as in Socrates' case, one's belief is precisely that no being should engage in such self-negligence. Parhesia, to say it all, from pan, all, and rhema, to say. Compare this with logorrhea, the flow of words. Logos, the word, and rhema, a flowing. Logorrhea has no imperative, no truth to reveal. Parhesia has a point built in. If there is a risk, then the truthfulness outlines its own necessity, regardless of any external conditions for it being true. So if parhesic speech is ontologically false, as long as great courage is required to deliver it, then we can at least rest assured that it is truthfully parhesic. Can we say something similar of logorrhea? Its connotation is one of excess, of prolixity. Prolixity. That would probably be pro and lexis. But by what system can we measure this excess? What exactly is the point of speech beyond which the flow of words accumulates? And what does one do with these extra words? Logos does not mean simply word. In fact, the Greek word lexis could be used to describe individual words, while logos means more precisely the word. In its proximity to logic, one begins to see the ties to its more complicated denotation, which is sometimes described as a unifying spiritual principle and sometimes as an overarching rational structure. The flow of structures, a unity that tumbles along after itself. Logorrhea begins to approach the ceaseless structuring and restructuring of the rhizome, of starting in the middle without origin or endpoint. Logorrhea does not reveal all, it simply reveals, reveals, reveals. It stutters but never stops uttering. Perhaps it doesn't so much declare to make clear, bring into the light of truth, as it does produce, to lead forth, to bring into a continual approach. Produce from the late 15th century to develop, be extended from the Latin producere, leader bring forth slash draw out from pro, forth, ducere, to bring, lead, see, duke. Sense of bring into being is first recorded 1510s, that of to put a play on stage is from 1580s. To continue producing is what Helen Siksu urges of women in The Laugh of the Medusa. A woman must write herself, she insists, and so doing, actively sees the opportunity to inscribe her whole individual body into a speech act, to reinsert purposefully that material identity wrested from her by a history of forcible silencing. She does not distinguish explicitly between written and oral language, but encourages the two to be used by a woman to forge for herself an anti-logos weapon. If logos is taken to express the unitary structure that can assume all logic under its umbrella, then the antilogos weapon of a woman's speech and writing must be a weapon that scatters, fractures, divides. For in writing the woman's body into her text, she is writing not the smooth mechanical body without organs of Deleuze and Guattari's anti-Oedipus, but a literally organic body, replete with organs, organs of all kinds, organs inside of, around other organs, a whole composed of parts that are wholes, not simple partial objects, but a moving, limitlessly changing ensemble. The notion of logos would imply a simpler, abstracted unity that logorrhea undermines with its corporeal expulsion. An excessive flow of logos means no logos at all. Logos holds together, logorrhea pulls apart. Logorrhea then begins to appeal to a broad egalitarian paradigm, an anti-hierarchical tool to provoke participation, sharing, and growth. But can the babbling non-teleology of logorrhea approach the ethical imperative of total revelation satisfied by parhesia? Or is it rather logorrhea that is animated by an ethics, surpassing the unspecifiable moral obligation of parhesia? By beginning in the middle, by throwing out as much as possible to see what sticks. Oh. My thingy froze. Can you embody the last great risk, total meaninglessness? Or is that even a risk at all? Is it not perhaps some great underlying likelihood? It seems perhaps we all totter on the edge of senselessness, more often than not turning our heads ever so slightly inward so as to avoid getting sucked into its persuasive pervasiveness. Is the key to push back at meaninglessness? Is it to find meaning in the meaninglessness? Or is it to eradicate the culturally manufactured gulf between the two? It is, in the end, ultimately a tautology. Whatever matters, matters. If I hold something up and say, this matters, does it achieve meaningfulness? Perhaps it must possess a structural logic that models the concept of making meaning to guide the viewer's process of interpretation. If it utilizes certain features or structures of image and information processing, does the habit of undergoing these processes start itself up in the brain? Is there an automatic biological affinity there? Our brains want to make meaning, this we know. Thus we get the theory of montage, etc., not so hard. But what about pointing to this process? What's the difference between using it, making its structure or function disappear, and pointing to it, digesting it, making it play itself? This latter process would seem to resemble quite simply the practice of structuralism. But is structuralism truly capable of pointing back outward, not just mumbling quietly that this is the structure of how this thing operates, but instead declaring loudly and fully that the structure of how this thing operates is parallel to the process by which we all make meaning in our lives, that this is not just observational or a commentary, but a practice itself of making meaning, that by identifying and expanding the structure of meaning-making, we might all inch slightly closer to the as-yet-unknown greater meaning that can be made. I was first accused of logorrhea in adolescence by my father, who explained the root of logos and allowed my imagination to fill in the blank by proximity to another well-known derivative of that original rhuma. From this, I developed a sense of it as word vomit, a flow that is, apart from all its unpleasantness, above all uncontrollable. Prolixity, verbosity, grandiloquence, and sesquipedality each imply a kind of pomposity, an intentional interpolation of supernumerary qualifiers and modifiers for the purposes of seeming, and here I risk sounding reductive, a bit smarter than perhaps you truly are. Logorrhea's embarrassment is located instead within its insuppressibility. Now logorrhea and paresia begin to approach one another. The imperative, the compulsion, despite embarrassment, despite risk, despite soiling one's own proverbial pants, the words, always in plural, must be thrown out. Whereas paresia requires complete revelation, my suspicion of such a totalizing impulse leads me to believe that logorrhea's ongoing flow might yield a more productive model, as long as it can somehow be corralled past the state of an utter helpless urge. The key to logorrhea might be in the careful application of intention to its effects, in the pushing of an arch loquacity ever so slightly towards the involuntary submission of the self, submission from sub under mitera, which is to send yourself under, as a vessel for the plurality of messages that must pass through. The confession or revelation, this channeling of great truths through a ceaseless flow, seems to hold great power. Beckett's protagonist champions plod on and on through circumlocutions until they find themselves at the heart of persistent human essence. I can't go on, I'll go on. Gertrude Stein is another example for whom narrative repetition is evinced both structurally and thematically as an essential practice for human comprehension. See, for example, her lectures, Narration. It is so, is it so, is it so, is it so, is it so? But in an image-saturated world, how can one hope to parse this endless flow with enough careful and sustained attention to make visible the invisible stoppages of desire that connect all the seemingly superfluous networks of information and activity? By expanding the examination of modest details over the vast span of a 60-year career, Giorgio Morandi manages to invest his precise work with the conditions of excess and structured his entire practice as a kind of endless, unchanging flow, or rather seemingly endless and seemingly unchanging, but in fact instead very limited and very grand at the same time and very carefully articulated. Morandi painted details that would appear inconsequential, how the ringed base of a wine bottle rests against a table, how the edge of a blue vase stands out against a clear white glass of a jar. And it is not through the mere act of painting, through pointing alone, that significance blossoms and quickens across the few bodies of work that comprise his career. It is, in fact, how attention is paid, not just because it is. By restricting the subject and treatment of his paintings to a narrow range of items within a narrow palette using a limited assortment of painterly marks, Morandi reduces the number of variables that could possibly open themselves up to reading, leaving the viewer little choice but to see the subtleties in the manifestation of proximate configurations. The smallest changes become enormous. They become the entire reason for a painting. such an infinitesimal adjustment becomes somehow almost grotesque in its enormity. It is tininess in excess. For something to be inconsequential implies that it has little effect, few consequences, from the Latin sequor, to follow. By the late 18th century, the word had obtained the connotation not worth noticing. From this, we can infer that that which has little effect has little value. Yet, though it may have little function outside of itself, what is painting if not a vast series of effects? By corralling objects that appear inconsequential into the logarithmic flow of repeated permutation, Morandi is indeed bringing an attention much stronger than simple noticing, and capably conveying the insistence that from small causes, many great effects can issue. To my horror, upon reaching this conclusion, I've discovered that I had inadvertently confirmed a faithfully held tenet of that universally harmonizing, retributive justice-wielding, early 18th century demon of my philosophical conscience, Wilhelm Gottfried von Leibniz, easily my least favorite of all the most widely studied rationalists. Leibniz believed that God had a general taste for the simplest of causes with the greatest effects. This unverifiable assertion about God's will stands itself as his explanation for how our world is the best of all possible worlds that God could have created, ideal in its simple harmony, yielding the richness of its manifestations. This argument greatly prefers efficiency over the entropy that I would normally argue instead seems to seep into and out of so much of our social and biological interaction with the world, but it works so marvelously in the art of Morandi that I can't help but incline towards its relevance in this case rather than its rejection. It is extremely difficult for me to reconcile the gaping holes that appear when I find myself reading a philosopher whose theories depend deeply on what I feel to be a gross mischaracterization, or worse, dangerous politics, but whose writing nonetheless contains some truths so powerful or potentially useful that I cannot reject every text wholesale. The risk of cherry-picking through a carefully constructed constellation of ideas seems ever greater the more one views them through a variety of post-structuralist lenses, such as rhizomatic structures, see Deleuze and Guattari, the death of the author, see Barthes, and the lack of any exteriority to a text, see Derrida. But what then is that risk anyway? What is the danger in instrumentalizing certain components of theories, massaging them until they serve other concepts, if the goal is to produce new possibilities for increasing understanding? In The Lightness of Theory from 1993, John Reichman warns of the heaviness that comes from working only with the dead ideas of long ago. But the story has always been the same. Philosophers converse, nitpick, cherry-pick, and ignore at will. They do so across distance, across time, and quite often within themselves. In his Ethics, Spinoza does away with the biggest problem he finds in other rationalist philosophers in the very first three pages of the geometrical proofs that comprise his text. It is regarding the nature of substance, and it is one of the most annotated debates in philosophical history, both analytic and continental. But Spinoza essentially just throws out the problem in three sentences. And why not? This is what thinkers are always doing. You throw something out there, see if it sticks, and if it wasn't working for you, throw it out into the garbage. Leibniz was selectively interested in Aristotle's theory of substantial forms. Deleuze became selectively invested in Leibniz's monadology, and so on. Is it so different from choosing to pay attention only to the subtle shift from gray to blue as the rim of a vase curves over the edge of a small wine cup? I am looking at a Morandi. I am looking at a painting by Morandi. I am looking at a picture of a painting by Morandi. It is printed in a book that I have borrowed from the university library. The painting was made in 1913. Morandi was about 23 years old. During this period, he destroys many of his works, I read in the biological outline at the back of the book. How lucky this one to be saved then, I think. I have seen the painting in person, but it is much too far to revisit for this analysis. It is in Italy, Morandi's native country, where the great majority of his paintings are held to this day. Morandi was from Bologna and very rarely left, but did so in 1909 and 1910 to see the Venice Biennale, which is what I was doing when I saw this painting, incidentally. It was not in the Biennale, but in Venice, and I was there. I was there, but also not really there, or for all intents and purposes not there, but still there, and at one point looking at this painting. In the reproduction I hold right now, it is much more yellow than I recall. I remember looking at off-white, sandy tones in a strangely cool dark green. There's a sickly pall to this print. The off-white looks jaundiced, and the coolness of the greens approaches a muddled neutral that detracts from the cleaner browns that hold down the vegetation in the middle of the image, as well as the very few modest, warm spots of pink that flicker up its left half. Despite these unavoidable inaccuracies, the print easily reproduces the painting's strange gravity. The centripetal force of the heterogeneous plant matter explodes from the center of the canvas, but stops sharply just short of its edges, threatening to consume the poorly visible bit of vase lurking beneath. There is indeed a vase, but the plants hardly notice it. The container for these particular vegetal items appears to be the canvas itself. Contain, from late 13th century Old French, contin, stem of contenir, from Latin contenere, transitive, to hold together and close, from com, together, and tenere, to hold, see tenet. The painting is called Flowers, but one can imagine a more immediately descriptive title. Leaves, perhaps, or plants. The flowers that one does see are few. A weak handful climbs the middle of the canvas, but tentatively. They look something like daisies, and do not appear attached to any stems. Rather, they rest gingerly atop a flat, broad leaf here, against the serrated teeth of a dry-looking fern there. A couple more flowers, the aforementioned daubs of warm pink, point away from the painting's center, having already been pushed nearly to the edges. It would seem that the flowers, the titular objects, are not the subject of the painting at all. This painting is exceptional. When you think of a Mirandi, you do not imagine this painting. You see bottles, pitchers, cups, a table, a wall, tans, blues, grays. For 60 years, Mirandi painted containers and vessels. He would even paint the surfaces of containers, so he was sometimes painting of a painted container. He pushed his slight surroundings through a sieve of unexplored possibilities, letting only the most minor variations remain visible. Mirandi made a practice of minutiae, and he practiced it over and over and over and over and over. Many have commented before me that the sheer generation of such material, absent any ostensible topic, removed from any progressive narrative, leaves one to conclude by exclusion that the subject of this practice is in fact this practice itself. This practice of sitting in a room, making a painting over and over, decision, execution, adjustment, decision, execution, adjustment, decision, execution, adjustment. The changes are small enough to track with certainty. You are there with these bottles again. If this practice expresses a worldview, it is of a very tiny world, almost wholly self-composed. These exemplary container paintings seduced artists young and old, past and present. I include myself in this admiration, of course, as I explained before. Mirandi's paintings do, however, tend to go over especially well with painters. Here's a painter who really understands what it's like to paint, a painter thinks. The self-imposed parameters, the external limitations, the slippage between convention and repetition, repetition and practice, the doing of it. Convention, which comes from con, together, and ven, the word for come. Even when he painted flowers, even before he could have had any clear idea what he was doing, what he was going to do, he stuck his subject directly into the surface of the painting itself and made the canvas hold its apparent objects, the flowers, or the leaves, the natural materials. The container object gets shunted down into the status of a barely rendered prop, a nominal acquiescence to the supposed necessity of stable ground. At this time, he had just discovered Cézanne, whose tables rise up to meet the surface of the picture plane, threatening to dump all those peaches out of their container and onto the viewer. Does the table hold the peach, or does the painting? And as the viewer holds the peaches in her gaze, all that is solid seems to melt into air, into shifting perspectives, rectilinear convolutions, and alarmingly material renderings. Cézanne, too, painted peaches over and over, though his topics range considerably more than Mirandi's. They grow more and less threatening to the viewer, their fragility in flux, their objective stability in question. Cézanne repeatedly asks not just what the peaches are, but how we perceive them, and shows how that very mental imaging constitutes their corporeal reality. And so too Mirandi, there with these bottles again. They are no different. What has changed? Only that you are there with these bottles right now. So there is no change in subject, topic, the painted object. It cannot change, but your position does. Your position must. Mirandi's paintings are not just about the vessel of painting itself, ever ready for a subject, but about you as the subject poured into this container, pouring into this container, always filling the painting when you look at it. Looking at the same bottle again, but it looks different. Looking at flowers again, but it looks different. Not just because it is now thin, printed on paper, and not thick and material and real before me as it was. It is also different because no matter where or when I see it, it will continue reproducing my looking anew. The painting is a container for the viewer to flow into, just as the performer is. And the tininess of his excess brings Mirandi into the ethical realm of the logorrheic, yet necessary Parisia-like utterance. Nonetheless, I find myself unable to commit to this kind of practice. It is difficult for me to understand why, especially given the similarity of his polysemantic play with the container and my exploitation of the double meaning of voice. The most lucid explanation I can articulate is that I see the world itself as a large polysemantic shifting container for all kinds of transformations. The world never changes and always does. This is our only real power. I try to wring meaning out of meaning, pick it up and plant it somewhere else, cultivate it, then cut it down and hang it up to dry, marvel at it some more, crush it up and dance in the handfuls of scattered powder it produces. I want my work to allow for spaces and times where different kinds of attentive activities can take place. Sometimes you have to saturate the attention of the mind to let the body's attention flex and take over. Attention is, of course, after all, to stretch towards something. Attend, circa 1300, to direct one's mind or energies from the old French attendre, 12th century modern French attendre, to expect, wait for, pay attention, and directly from Latin attendere, give heed to, literally to stretch toward, from ad to, plus tendere, stretch, see tenet. The notion of stretching one's mind towards something, sense of take care of, wait upon, is from early 14th century, meaning to pay attention is early 15th century. That of to be in attendance is mid 15th century. Related, attended, attending. There is a suspension, a sense that all things are moving and thus must be attended to for meaning to accrete. Meaning is not instantaneous or intrinsic. It is formed, a process. Why else would it be called meaning, a gerund? Reframing logos again with meaning in the place of organizing principle or the word allows logorrhea to obtain a sense of the flow of meaning. My logorrhea is not a stream of terms that could be grouped and refined, but a stream of meanings that have their own trajectory and can be held for a moment but then must be let go. None of my ideas are formally fixed. I need a framework that allows for the frame to be moved, or pulverized and dissolved, or expanded like a new wing for one's house. Painting, though in some ways inexhaustible, is not without its limits. In fact, the great and satisfying challenge of painting is to keep the limitations within view. The way an idea is both held back and launched by these limitations generates tremendous oscillating energy. You can build a lifetime's practice off of that kind of self-generative, self-regenerating dialogic energy. But I'm beginning to accept for myself that my focus, my tendency, my energy simply does not want to move only back and forth. Rather than the reflective model of light waves bouncing off the surface of the paint and hitting your eyes, I produce a vibrating, absorptive model of sound waves bouncing from surface to surface, sinking in here and there, hitting your ears and your skin in cascading resonances, echoes, and morphing decays. Residual energy waves scatter in all directions. When live, sound is produced, lingers, and then fades. This formal structure is organized over time, but its expression is affected very significantly, though often more or less invisibly, by the space in which it is produced. I have wondered if a sound could perhaps effect a physical transformation in a space or object, but the goal is not to produce physically ephemeral traces. It is, in fact, to discover new potential forms of transcription. New records, new kinds of records for the things that happen in real time and real space all around us. Just as a cloth or text is a surface, text, late 14th century, wording of anything written from Old French text, Old Norse French text, 12th century from Latin textus, the scriptures, text, treatise, written account, content, characters used in a document, from textus, style or texture of a work, literally thing woven, from the past participle stem of texere, texere, to weave, from the Proto-Indo-European root tek, make, see, texture. Texture, early 15th century network structure, from Latin textura, web, texture, structure, from stem of texera, to weave. An ancient metaphor, thought is a thread and the raconteur is a spinner of yarns, but the true storyteller, the poet, is a weaver. The scribes made this old and audible abstraction into a new invisible fact. After long practice, their work took on such an even, flexible texture that they called the written page a textus, which means cloth. That's from Robert Bringhurst's Elements of Typographic Style. But one that can be penetrated, saturated, and filled, I want to measure the volume of a vocalization. Volume, late 14th century roll of parchment containing writing, large book, from Latin volumen, genitive voluminous, roll as a manuscript coil wreath from Volvere to turnaround roll, meaning book forming part of a set, 1520s, is from a sense in French. A movement or the imprint of an object or event. Linen, spun into some of the most ancient cloths, has long been prized for its strength and smoothness, its coolness to the touch in warm weather, the length of its fibers, and many other attractive, useful attributes. For hundreds of years, it preceded cotton duck as the ideal, flexible support for canvas paintings, and has been used in bookbinding, undergarments, even currency. Of greatest aesthetic and conceptual consequence for my practice, however, is its lack of elasticity. Though fine and strong, linen does not stretch easily. The result is a fiber that stays where you put it. As you use it, the traces of your interaction are imprinted directly onto the weave of the garment. Linen wrinkles. It reveals an accumulated history of use. Tracing the history of a usage over time as it changes and develops could be a way to understand this logorrhea I describe as a flow of meanings, the fracturing structure of Sixu's antilogos weapon. Rather than any one stabilized lockdown meaning, a palimpsest of interactions lets meaning be located at any moment in the past, and thus perhaps any moment in the future as well. It allows meaning to become actively produced, not simply registered at one particular moment in one particular place and then set aside. It is in fact quite like the difference between an etymology and a definition. Define, late 14th century, to specify, to end. From Old French, definir, definir, to finish, conclude, come to an end, bring to an end, define, determine with precision, and directly from Latin, definire, to limit, determine, explain, from de, completely, and finire, to bound, limit, from finis, boundary, end, see finish. The etymology demonstrates ways in which language is and has been actively, transformatively used by a range of subjects, either with intention or by custom, and all the slippery possibilities that appear and disappear over time and spaces. If the dictionary definition is perhaps a snapshot, then the etymology is a performance. It is a form that resides alongside us in the real space-time of our lived experience, providing a model and method for an active engagement in the production of meaning and value in our lives.
That was fast.
Yeah, it blew by.
I have 50 etymologies I figured I didn't have time for.
Yeah.
Still very, very fast. We actually had the original fast-talking woman on the show a while ago.
Who was that?
That was... oh, geez, this is embarrassing. Well, but anyway, I think there was some interesting things. I'll remember as we talk this out.
Sure.
Because I think in some ways this was an interesting talk vis-a-vis the entire project of the talking show.
Oh, certainly.
Like very, very germane to the entire project of the entire radio show we've been doing all this time, i.e. like logorrhea as a topic. Nicholas.
Yes. You want me to expound on logorrhea?
Well, what have we been doing this whole time?
We've just been talking.
An uninterrupted stream of talking for going on 4 years now.
Yeah, a profound attempt to not capture anything into its meaning.
And also sort of just...
I have a question.
Yeah. Okay.
So you knew Edelman before the talking.
I've known Karen for a little bit. We are acquaintances at best, I would say. That would be about reasonable.
Okay, sure. Have you seen does she make paintings?
I've actually only known her to do talking.
Okay.
The first time Karen and I met, we met at a panel or a forum. And she really, no, it was actually about climate change, and she really let it rip on the audience, and I was like, oh, well, climate change aside,
wow,
I have an interest in talking, and perhaps we should have a discussion about that.
That makes sense. I mean, tonight's performance was somewhat of a guitar solo of the mind.
I would, yeah, indeed, definitely a full-on guitar solo of the mind.
There was something. So she said, maybe she didn't say this on air, but she said it beforehand that it was part of her MFA thesis, and to me, it was kind of the perfect MFA thesis because there was all this talk of Mirandi, but the way critical theory was presented as a kind of still life in itself, which is, I feel like, is the way in which it's presented to you in a master's program as a kind of perfectly crystallized knowledge that you're then supposed to consume.
I think that's an interesting thing that's different from me coming from an actual academic thinking background, is that they would let you look at that stuff as some sort of weird move,
like right, like you're studying chess matches or something.
Yeah, everyone would look at
this is your science degree.
You're doing an MFA, and everyone would say like, so this is bad you.
Right, and here's what happens.
So. And they would treat it like it was a thing that was real. Whereas in a philosophy department, they would be like, well, if this is a move you want to make, you can. This is a move you could do this.
Those books are on
to.
That shelf.
Those books, yeah, precisely, exactly. If this move looks interesting to you, you can look for that over there, and the implication would also be that over there was not where you were. I was.
Well, you had to kind of you had to really back it up.
Well, no, like a continental philosophy department where I was from was maybe getting to Hegel soon.
Mm-hmm.
You know, was like on the fence on whether Hegel was going to work out or not. Like I'm talking about a slow moving academic environment.
Did you get locked out?
I mean, I became a musician.
It was a joke, Steve.
As an interaction with that, so I can firmly say yes. I was driven into the hideous arms of music, and was subsequently absorbed through music into visual art.
Hmm. Speaking of absorption, I couldn't help but think during the part about. Where Cameron was talking about her theories of sound, I often leave the stereo going in my studio in hopes that it'll somehow penetrate the walls and add a kind of, so I get like a nice like terroir of my studio.
Right. So like, it'll change.
Yeah, like what happens if I just play White House for like a month? Does that change the work? And if I change to Vivaldi, like what happens then?
I think White House and Vivaldi are the same band.
White House and
the same hateful sound.
Yeah.
The same rapey and hateful. No, I don't know. I'm not going to. Vivaldi is perfectly lovely. I'm just being a dick.
Well done.
I did it. I did it.
What did you think about Quixote's contribution?
I think what was amazing, and we should fill this in for our radio audience, is that Karen talked so quickly. And the whole time she was talking, there was a squirming dog in her arms.
Yeah.
And there was, I feel, very little indication in the oral performance that was the case.
Well, it was Quixote's critique of still life, I think.
Sure. And in well, to be fair, in a way, also an interesting gloss on a bit that Karen said earlier about the and this was something that I hadn't really thought of, but I think is a really good point, is that the Deleuze-Guattarian body without organs fundamentally denies like a female process by which, like, whether or not one chooses to produce offspring, one could engender in one's body another organism, right? So it's like, whether or not there is a body without, I mean, no, however you feel about that, it's a fundamentally male view that you cannot actually within your body contain a whole other organism with its own organs. Right. And that I had never actually, maybe I just hadn't been hanging out in the right scenes. But that specific, like, not like I wasn't aware of gaps in the Deluso Guitarian boom belt.
Smooth gaps.
Yeah, it's not like I thought, oh yeah, that, those guys nailed it. But like there's plenty of room to improve on the Deluso Guitarian framework in my mind.
Steve, those are where those books are. But that's where those books are.
Those books are on the shelf to your left. But
to the right of the Badu.
But I hadn't actually taken sort of a literal reading on Body Without Organs against the sort of fundamentals of like human reproduction. In a sense that admired the feminine in that way. And so where was I going? I had a whole argument planned out from that Deluso, that gap in the Deluso Guitarian area.
I still can't get over the choice of Mirandi. What did you think about that?
I think Mirandi's a great metaphor for actually what we've been doing with the talking, separate from the whole thing. Like,
I'm sure that was our goal, is to create, you know, a 2-year-long metaphor for the future talking show that we were doing.
I feel the discussion of Mirandi in Karen's talk was the most coherent overview of what we've been doing with the talking show for the last 4 years. That's the most meta the show has ever gotten.
Political talking.
Well, not exclusively,
but Asia.
Oh man, this was a good. How apt? How apt was today's listeners? Call in and let us know if you thought today was an apt day,
or just call in if you want to talk to Quixote.
Call in general, and just let us know that you are alive and you are within 700 feet. Of the K-Chuck
transmitter. Yeah, all the way to Alpine.
Mine friends, good night to you.
Sleep tight, Chinatown.
Stay warm.